Welcome back. This is the second section of our interview with Tim Keller here on Desiring God Live. We're capturing this here on Roosevelt Island, just off New York City's Upper East Side. We're here in the home of Tim and Kathy Keller. Thanks for having us. And we want to talk a little bit now about your book, Generous Justice. So I wonder if, just right off the bat, what's the thesis of the book? What's the main point you're trying to make?
It's in the subtitle, Grace Makes Us Just. So just to draw that out just the tiniest bit, the more you understand the gospel of grace with the mind and experience with the heart, the more likely you are to care about people who are poor, marginalized, hungry. I think that's actually a very important biblical theme. So justice is not part of the gospel, but anyone who understands the gospel, it moves you toward living a just life. That's the thesis.
And why, briefly, did you write it then? Are you saying that's you're looking around, that's not happening very much in terms of motivating people? Or
I mentioned in the intro, I mentioned several reasons. So, and I don't want to take too long, but I'd say there are people on one side. Here's two reasons.
Now, who's your audience?
Well, the two main audiences are Christians who are going. Getting very enthusiastic about justice.
So they're zealous to do justice,
whatever
that means.
But they don't necessarily, they haven't thought about how does this fit in with everything else Christians are supposed to do. In fact, it can almost overwhelm everything else, and this is the only thing Christians should do. And on the other hand, actually, I think there's people reacting to that right now, perhaps overreacting, or at least reacting. And they don't like any talk about Christianity and social justice at all.
Suspicious of it?
It's suspicious of it for several reasons. I think the best reason is because they're afraid that it's going to smother the primacy of the ministry of the word.
Okay.
In the life of the church. I think a less worthy reason is people are afraid that any talk of social justice means liberal politics. And some people feel like, well, since we don't believe in liberal politics, we can't talk about social justice. But I think you've got to be informed by the Bible. You can't be reacting to political parties that you don't like. You need to be informed by the Scripture.
Okay. What, does the book have a word to the skeptic as well? The person who's...
All my books try to. There's a chapter, especially near the end, I'd say the last two chapters are particularly for people who are skeptics. I worry a little bit that a really secular person might not wade through the first five chapters, which are almost nothing but Bible exposition and exegesis. However, to my surprise, I have seen, for example, Publishers Weekly, which doesn't do little reviews on most Christian books, and didn't review my last couple, but wrote a review saying this is a really important book because it's so balanced and it's biblical and yet it's talking about social justice. And that's a secular group. And they liked the book and felt like it was an important book, which surprised me because my last few books, which I love very much, they didn't think were significant enough to even review. So perhaps there is something for them as well.
Okay. Why are you interested in justice? What are the roots of this in your own life? Where's this coming from?
Well, actually, my own story is when I was in West Hopewell Presbyterian Church in the late 70s, I thought I would do a doctor of ministry because being a Presbyterian, I felt all Presbyterian ministers wish they were doctors. So you just need to know that. So the joke, of course, is that 50% of all Presbyterian ministers are doctors, and the other 50% are working on it. They're figuring it out.
Very good.
I went to Westminster Seminary. My advisors there, I had originally said to them, maybe I'll do something on elder training. And I remember George Fuller, who was the president of Westminster at the time and was an advisor of mine, said, do deacons. He says, everybody does elders. He says, everybody's neglecting the diaconate. And he gave me a book called Service in Christ, edited by James McCord. It was not a particularly evangelical book. It was just a series of learned essays on diaconia, which was the church's deed ministry through the years. And through also told me quite a bit about the diaconate. especially as it developed in the continental churches, you know, in the Netherlands and other places like that. And it fascinated me. So I did my whole Doctor of Ministry program on how to train deacons to make them into ministers of mercy and not just janitors and treasurers. Mm-hmm. In Presbyterian churches, deacons tend to be just the people who fix up the building. But originally in Presbyterian ecclesiology, the deacons were people who cared for the poor. And so that's where actually my interest started, because I did my whole doctor ministry on that, and I found there are rich resources in traditional Reformed theology for what was, you know, called the ministry of mercy, mm-hmm. caring for the poor. And that's where it started.
Yeah. Do you see that that book, On Mercy Ministry, fitting together with Generous Justice as a primer, or as a step one, step two, or as an early understanding of your theology in this area, and now this is the more mature version? Or are these books really separate reads?
No, they complement each other. There's one chapter in the Ministry of Mercy book that I talk about justice, but I don't really develop it. Hmm. And so this is, you might say this is more of a development of it.
I see. Okay.
However, the Ministry of Mercy book, is the last half is extremely practical. And actually, in some ways, it still wouldn't be a bad book to read as a follow-up to the Justice book. Because my Justice book had to be a little more broad brush. Mm-hmm. There was so much to say.
Sure.
And in the end, I didn't really get down to brass tacks. Well, what would you do right now in your little church in your town? So they would supplement each other. There'll be the treatment of the Good Samaritan parable. Mm-hmm. I do that with... I give an extended treatment in both books, so there'd be some overlap. And you're going to see a person who is 25 years younger, and it might be interesting to compare them. But apart from that, they actually complement each other.
They do. All right. Well, define justice for us here tonight. What do you mean when you're calling people to do justice? What are you calling them to do?
Giving everybody what they deserve.
All right. Tease that out a little bit.
Well, see, there's two such radically different aspects to it. First of all, to give people what they deserve means when someone is doing wrong, when someone is doing evil, you should stop them. You should stop them, and you should punish them. You should give them what they deserve. And that there's a law and order part of justice, which is very, very important. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, because every human being is in the image of God, Nicholas Woolstorff, in the last couple of years, wrote a book called Justice, Rights, and Wrongs, which is not an easy book to read. It was written by a top-tier philosopher to other philosophers. What he would say is that a person in the image of God comes into your presence with certain claims on you, and that is they have the right not to be killed, not to be beaten, not to be... There's a whole lot of things. Now, I think we all intuitively know because in the image of God, we may not treat them in certain ways. And therefore, they deserve to be treated with dignity. They deserve to be treated with a certain amount of kindness. See, that's the opposite, in a way, of law and order. The law and order side is, if they've done wrong, they deserve to be punished. But the other side is, as people in the image of God, they deserve a certain kind of fair treatment, care. And you have to go through the whole Bible to find out what those things are. And that's the reason why the whole Bible really is about living justly. You have to say, what does your neighbor deserve from you? You know, there's a place in Proverbs 3 where it says, do good to your neighbor because it belongs, you know, it's actually a very hard text to translate, but the best translations, I think, is do good to your neighbor if they have need, which is their due. Now, you owe it to them to love them. In fact, Paul says so. You know, Paul, of course, says, you owe no one anything except the debt of love. You owe it to people to love them. And so that's the reason why justice in the end becomes a very big comprehensive thing. Maybe too comprehensive for some people's tastes. Some people have actually said your definition is too broad, but I think it's what the Bible says. It's what Paul says.
Yeah,
you owe it to people to love them.
I think a lot of people hear justice and they think charity. And you want to distinguish those?
Not too much. On the law and order side, which I think the word mishpat, the Hebrew word mishpat, generally means more righting wrongs, finding people who are doing unjust things, mistreating people, harming people, killing people. You stop them. You put them in jail, whatever. That's law and order, and that's more negative. It's mishpat. tzedakah, which is another word that means righteousness or justice, sure, has more to do with living in just relationships. Yeah. And just relationships means living in your community where you're treating people with dignity. You know, frankly, the best place to see tzedakah is Job 29 and Job 31, where he says, when I see a person who's blind, I do this. When I see a person who's poor, I do this. When I see a person who's a widow and the orphan is what I do. And those things we actually owe people, as far as I can see, in Job 29 and 31. And so, in a sense, charity is not coerced by the government. It's voluntary giving. And yet, from God's point of view, he expects you to be generous with what you have. If you have more than someone else, you should be generous with it. And in that sense, it's justice to be generous. Now, some people say that's just not true. Justice is only, is punishing evildoers, and charity is not part of justice. But actually, I argue in the book that it is.
Well, you take a lot of time, and I so appreciated the first, I don't know, two or three chapters of the book where you really unpacked the Old Testament teaching on this subject. What do you say to the person who would maybe hear that and say, yeah, but that's the Old Testament. How do you go to the laws that governed a theocratic nation, and how do you extrapolate from that mandates for the church today? Walk us through that a little bit.
With care. I mean, the basic principle is the Old Testament laws have some abiding validity, but Christ changes it. So, you have the gathering up of the manna. You were supposed to gather and not hoard it, and everybody's supposed to have, you know, equal amount. So you have these rules for gathering the manna, which clearly are not applying to us because we don't get manna. And yet Paul, in 2 Corinthians 8, when he says in 9, when he's talking about how if you're a church with more money, and here's a church of more poor people, you know, like, you know, the poor Christians there because of the famine, you should give to them so that there would be equality, so no one has any lack. And he quotes the passage on manna to show that that the principle's still there. And then, of course, there's a pretty, a very poignant one is the place where in Deuteronomy 15, where it says, there should be no poor among you. This is, I think, verse 4.
Yes.
Because if everybody is really living justly the way God wants you to, there won't be any permanent poor people among you. They may fall into poverty, but you'll lift them out because you'll all be so generous. And that's in the Septuagint version of Deuteronomy 15:4 is actually quoted in Acts 4, where it says, because everyone shared their income with each other, there were no poor among them. It's a direct quote. So even though it's not the same, it's not a theocracy, it's not done sort of coercively, there's no taxation the way it was in the Old Testament, and you had to give to the Levites, and you had to give, and the land went back to Jubilee principle every 50 years. All that is now fulfilled in Christ, and yet there's some abiding validity that you can see in the way Paul and Luke look at the justice of the Old Testament and say that should somehow still characterize, somehow, our relationships as in the church. So you can't just write all that justice stuff off and say it's the Old Testament.
So you make the point in the book that basically in the Deuteronomy 15 passage, if Israel was living the way they were supposed to be living, extreme poverty, ongoing poverty, ought not to happen.
Right, that's right.
And you see that carrying over in how the New Testament church dealt with their own, as it were, in the quote from Acts chapter 4, and there were no needy persons among them.
Right.
Do you see in that any suggestion of the primacy, or maybe a triage of when it comes to doing justice, the corporate community should care for its own first?
Yes.
And then look outward?
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, it's natural. I mean, Galatians 6:10 says, do good to all men, especially the household of faith. It's actually not that hard to see. In my own family, let's say my first response, if somebody falls into need within my immediate family or my siblings or my wife's siblings, you know, in other words, if I see people inside our family beginning to fall into poverty, they're our primary responsibility to help out. We might have to really dig down deep to help them so they don't lose their home, so they don't, you know, go into poverty or something like that. Then in my church, that's the next level of responsibility. They're the next level, more than just anybody. The people in my own church, they're brothers and sisters, and we've got to help them. And then you move on out a little further, I think you have the church in general, and then you have everybody. I mean, not too long, when I was in South Africa, same time Pastor John was there, even though, and you were there too,
that's right.
we never even met there. I visited the home of a wonderful Christian woman in Soweto, you know, in the black township.
Sure.
She lived in a shanty town. She was a vibrant Christian woman. She lives in conditions that, you know, I think any American would just find absolutely astonishing and appalling. And she's a Christian. What's my responsibility to her? Isn't she in the household of faith? Yes. So I don't know quite what I'm supposed to do about that, but I do think that I have some responsibility. If you're a Christian in Minneapolis, I think you have, according to Galatians 6:10, some responsibility to what are we supposed to be doing for those folks? There's a lot of poor Christians in the world. So I do think it's intuitive and biblical that you have a stages of responsibility. Most for your immediate family, next for your local church community, next for Christians anywhere in the world, and next for your neighbors, sure, your non-Christian neighbors, and next for any human being. So I could actually go out to five or six sort of layers or levels.
Let's go to your chapter on justice and Jesus, and you talk about the parable of the Good Samaritan, and maybe that's a good segue then. So you're out now at that kind of wider, if you've got concentric circles, we're now talking the parable of the Good Samaritan. Talk about the influence of that parable in shaping your own understanding of what generous justice is all about.
Well, that parable goes all the way out to the edge. Mm-hmm. The idea of putting a Samaritan and a Jew together in the parable is a way of Jesus showing that in the end, any human being in the image of God is your neighbor, and you can't completely get rid of your obligation to help. That's all. I mean, also I heard Ed, you know, it's typical, I heard Ed Clowney expound it long ago. I don't even know where. I don't know we had any written sermon by him on it, but I heard him expound it once, and it was just amazing. And it just went through me, and then I made it the basis for the book on Ministry of Mercy. The main idea, though, was that that Ed showed me was that if he'd put a Jew on the horse, you might, and a Samaritan in the road, and told a Jewish man the story, and said a Jewish man was going on the road and he saw a Samaritan, you know, beaten and robbed and lying half dead. What should that man have done? And of course, the Jewish listener to the parable would have said, run over him and put him out of his misery. You know, he's a Samaritan. We hate Samaritans. They hate us. You know, that's the way. But by putting the Jew, you know, he's telling a story to a Jewish man, putting the Jew in the road and a Samaritan in the place of power, and saying, if you were in the road and you were about to die and a Samaritan came along, what would you want him to do? And the answer is, I would want him to show mercy on me. Then he says, then you must show mercy on anybody in your road, no matter who they are, whether a believer or non-believer. I mean, to me, that's the strongest statement where Jesus says, you do have to take care of the non-believer too, if they're in your road. Now, what does that mean? You know, and people always say to me, I'm overwhelmed with the needs of the world. How in the world? Whenever people say to me, how in the world are we going to take care of everybody in the world? You know, they read the book and they say, you're just making me feel guilty. I only have limited means. And I always say, look, you never decide, churches never say, we only have enough money to obey 8 of the 10 commandments this year.
That's right.
Because there's a recession on.
Right.
No, what you do is you take the money you've got to obey all 10 commandments and you just do your best with the money you've got. And I just say, you know, you look out there and there's plenty of needs and you only have so much time and energy and money, and use what you have on the needs that are there. That's all.
And the reality, too, of this parable you cite in the book later on, Jonathan Edwards' argument toward the fact that it really will cost you something.
Yes.
There's a real sacrifice involved in being generous in dispensing justice.
Yeah, that's where he says, look at that term, bear one another's burdens.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you realize what that means is, if you bear somebody's burdens, that should burden you, or you're not really helping them. And the illustration is, if somebody's carrying a 100-pound weight and you're going to help them bear the burden, then a certain amount of that burden will fall on you. And then he gives an example that is just so brilliant. He says, if somebody says, I can't afford to help the poor, he turns around and says, well, what you mean is you can't afford helping the poor without it burdening you. And therefore, he says, but that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to help the poor in such a way that it's a problem, that it means giving up something. It means really, it should really create almost a hardship. And he says, well, but that's what it means. They're in hardship. If you're going to bear their burden, some of that hardship falls on you. I mean, Edwards was devastating in that that famous, that treatise on Deuteronomy 15. Mm. It was originally a sermon. Mm. It's called The Duty of Charity. And it was originally a sermon, and he developed it into a long treatise, and he put it out there. And he devastates anybody's objections to caring for the poor in ways that only Edwards could do.
Yeah, wonder if they abuse it. Wonder if they don't repay me. Wonder if they don't snap out of their bad habits. Wonder, you know, all of the modern 21st century objections,
right.
He really blows them away.
Yeah.
Who is the Great Samaritan? I love this little, just a few pages in the book, a really beautiful unpacking of the Great Samaritan. Who's the Great Samaritan?
Well, that's what I got from Ed Clowney long ago. I mean, I remember him saying, I said, well, who is it that has come along and found us lying in our own blood, lying practically half dead in the road, and who does not owe us anything but the opposite of mercy? See, Samaritans and Jews hated each other, and therefore the Samaritan owed the Jew, because probably the Jews had hurt the Samaritan, you know, that did not owe the Jew mercy. He owed him something else. So who came along, found us laying in our blood, and actually owed us not mercy but the opposite, and yet got down, put us in his place, at his own expense has healed us? Does that sound like anybody? I mean, that's, you might call it sanctified imagination, but it's Jesus. Jesus is the Great Samaritan who found us and owed us not mercy but judgment. Instead of judgment, gave us mercy, put us in his place, takes us and heals us. Yeah, it's, that's another place where Ed Clowney, you know, changed my life. I heard that. I said, boy, what does that mean? Then along comes the Doctor of Ministry Project, which led me into the whole subject. And that's the only reason why the book is out there now.
Amen. Amen. Well, you talk about moving toward the second half of the book now. You talk about the levels of involvement there can be in doing justice. And I was really helped by three clear categories that you established here. The idea of we can provide relief, then there's development, and there's social reform. Can you just briefly unpack those three levels for us?
Yeah, relief is picking the guy up. This is what the Samaritan did, the Good Samaritan. Okay, relief is saying, oh, look at this person. He needs medical care. He needs transportation. He needs he needs money to subsidize his stay at the hospital. And that's relief. At the other end of the spectrum is reform. I'll jump over the middle one. Now, here's what reform is. The Samaritan, every single month, the Samaritan takes this road down to Jericho, finds another guy, and says, we got to do something about this. Instead of me just picking these people up, we need better police protection, or we have to figure out what's going on. And he decides to do public policy change so that he doesn't have to be constantly picking people up out of the road all the time. That's reform. Now, development, actually, I don't know, I have to leave the metaphor now. I don't know how development is taking somebody who's hungry and homeless, and not just simply giving them something to eat and something to a place to stay, but doing job training, or perhaps counseling for drug problems, drug addiction, to put them in the position where they actually can get on their own two feet, and that they no longer need to be a recipient of charity. But they can not only work, but they can actually become a giver to people in need instead of a recipient. So relief is just patching them up. Development is putting them in a position of self-sufficiency. And reform is changing public policy so people don't keep ending up down in the gutter.
And individuals can embrace that as well as organizations, churches, and other ministries. That model of looking for relief, ways to provide development, and macro solutions in the reform level.
Yeah, and it's not just that. It's also you can do it corporately as well as individually. And you can, what I mean by that is corporations as bodies as well as individuals can do it, yes. But you can also do it for bodies or individuals. So to develop a family, to get them out of poverty, might mean you you provide childcare for the single mother so she can go get a certificate in something, so she can go to school and get a certificate, so she can get a job by which she can support herself. And so you give her the money to go, you pay her rent while she's going, you watch her kids and help her in all those ways, and get the kids a big brother because they need a man, you know, kind of a friend, at least the boys do. And that's it can all be done by one individual family for another individual family. The other thing is a community development corporation, a Christian community development corporation, can adopt 10 blocks and say, we're going to try to turn a very poor area into a working class area. We're going to help people rehab their homes. We're going to try to help them get jobs. We're going to try to make the public school in that place better so the kids coming up actually were able to go on to college, and adopt an entire area and do development of the whole area together, not just to one person individually.
Good. Well, in your chapter on doing justice in the public square, you talk about two aspects that should characterize the Christian's work: humble cooperation and respectful provocation. Mm-hmm. Unpack that a little bit for us.
Well, I'll give you a perfect example. Humble cooperation means you work with people together who are non-Christians to deal with a problem like sex trafficking. You're trying to stop it in your city. You've got some Mormons, you've got some Orthodox Jews, you've got some secular atheists, and they all want to help you. A humble cooperation means you don't treat them as second-class citizens, and you say, all right, well, we're trying to do this, and let's do it together, okay? And not try to set yourself up as when it comes to evangelism, the only other people who are going to help you evangelize your city are other Christians. Mm. But when it comes to doing justice, there are plenty of people who are not Christians who want to help. And I think humble cooperation means not treating them as second-class citizens and saying, okay.
You hit on common grace here as being a significant aspect.
Right, yes, because, you know, an atheist shouldn't really, doesn't have an intellectual, I might as well say this, an atheist doesn't really have the intellectual warrant to believe in human dignity.
Mm-hmm.
Because we just are here by accident, you know. We evolved out of lower life forms, and we feel that human beings have this great dignity. But actually, why? And yet, all atheists still know intuitively that human beings have dignity. They know that we're in the image of God, even though they would never admit it. And so, by common grace, they have the same. They have a value there you can work on. However, respectful provocation means you do have to, I think, explain to people when they want to know, why are you so involved in this justice issue? They say, because of my beliefs in Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And not be afraid to say that. I give you a great example. The abolitionists, very often the abolitionists said, we have a vision for a slave-free country, a country where there's no more slavery. Mm-hmm. And no matter who you are, if you want to help us get there, we'll work together. We'll be equal partners. We want you to know, though, that we're getting our passion for abolition out of our Christian beliefs. It's Jesus and what he's done for us and his liberating of us. That's the reason why we're willing to do this. That's why we're willing to put our lives on the line for these slaves. But if you, for other reasons, want to help us, you are an equal partner. So there's a combination there of both witnessing to Christ at the same time inviting them in. And you know, that's very, very, in the end, attractive. If you want a great witness, that's the way to do it. You're open about it, but at the same time, very non-condescending to them. You want their help and you want to, you know. So that's the balance between respectful provocation, saying, but we're Christians, and this is where we get our values, and humble cooperation.
Have you found in the course of your ministry there are times where the need is so great, or the injustice is so beyond the pale that you have to come in with a greater sense of prophetic edge to be heard or to make the point or to lead the way.
Perhaps. And I mean, my temperament isn't to do that. Some people's temperament is, but I've always appreciated the ones who do. Some people are like Luther. I'm not actually, as much as I love Luther, I do not have his bull in a china shop kind of temperament. And sometimes, there's been, by the way, it's not just Christians. There are numbers of people who are really activists and have gotten a lot of good done in the world, partly by being very prophetic, strident perhaps in some cases, and often getting people mad. But it's the best way to go.
And to the example that you just gave there, does that presuppose that the church or the Christians in your case were leading the way? In other words, does cooperation in the name of doing social justice, is it easier when you're setting the agenda and you have the platform, as it were, as opposed to the candlelight vigil over in the park here that might be happening tonight that's run by some group that you really don't, you're not comfortable associating with, even though you care about stopping crime?
Right. Easier. Yes. If it was your idea, in other words, and if you put up, I don't know how to say, if you put up the social, maybe financial, and emotional capital to get something started, I think you have got more right to talk about the Christianity. In the city here, for example, there's a, some Christians got together, a really good organization to try to help women out of sexual slavery, basically, out of sex trafficking and prostitution, things like that. And they've gotten some very, very good press recently, where secular pundits and people have noticed it and said how great it is, that kind of thing. Because Christians started it, they have much more of a right to talk about Christianity and set the agenda. If you go into a good cause, but one started by other folks, very often you just don't have the same, frankly, you don't have the same right to do respectful provocation. You know, if you want to come along, you should. It would probably look like you're trying to take control. So the answer is yes. It's helpful if you started it.
Lead the way. Sure.
It does help.
Yeah.
But I don't think it doesn't mean that Christians can't be, as individuals, there's no reason why Christians can't be involved in a local tutoring program for the kids in a public school and they can probably find opportunities to share their faith with the families. But inside the organization, it would probably be rude. For them to be sticking up and talking about their Christian commitment all the time.
Well, as we close this section in discussing your book, I thought one of the most, back to your thesis now as well, that it is a profound experience of the grace of God that changes our understanding of these things. I was really helped by, in a couple of different sections, how you hit on this issue of what should motivate us. You cite Jonathan Edwards' teaching, about the believer who appropriates the grace of God and thus is able to see the beauty of God. And that changing and granting whole new motivations for living a life of generous justice. Can you talk about that a little bit, the connection between seeing beauty and doing justice?
Well, see, that's more along the lines of the Desiring God book, which maybe we can talk about in a second. I think when I first read Desiring God by John Piper, he really was attracted to Edwards' idea of excellency, which is Edwards' coined word that's probably his best paraphrase as beauty, the idea that God is beautiful and glorious and the purpose of, and the, in fact, the essence of worship is to enjoy him. To enjoy God is because he's an end in himself. He's just beautiful. The illustration I like to use is that I'll pay a lot of money to listen to Mozart because I love Mozart. So why? What am I getting out of Mozart? What's the value? And the answer is it's beautiful. So, well, why are you listening to Mozart? Well, what are you getting out of it? I said, I'm not getting anything out of it. It's an end in itself. It's beautiful. And therefore, I just enjoy it and it just enriches me, etc. So what I get from Edwards is that God's the excellency of God means that we should enjoy Him and we find Him beautiful. And When we find him beautiful, that changes us. It fills us. It puts us in a less needy position. John Piper would say there's a joy, there's a kind of overflow. Now, what I try to do in the book was bring out the fact that a woman named Ellen Scarry at Harvard mm-hmm. wrote a book called On Beauty and Being Just. And I read the book some years ago, and it was intriguing. She basically was trying to give a secular account of what Edwards talks about. She felt that an experience of beauty decenters you. It makes you less selfish and needy, makes you happier, and makes you therefore more attentive to other people. And she gives an example that I use in the book where Iris Murdoch, who is a philosopher, talks about how she was filled with self-pity, so she saw this beautiful bird soaring, and the beauty of it smote her heart. And then afterwards she said, why am I being so self-centered? And so the idea is an experience of beauty somehow decenters you from self-centeredness, and it makes you more willingness to be attentive to other people's needs. And I read that, and I decided, and I saw some other secular reviewers who said that doesn't really work. And they actually talked about the fact that the Nazis listened to, you know, they went out and killed people during the day, and they slaughtered people at night and that kind of thing. And they were filled with beauty. But I kept saying, you know what, I think that she's trying to get at something that Edwards had and it was right about. I don't think just beauty in general makes you good and just. But I do sense that the being smitten with the beauty of God takes you out of yourself so that you're no longer so filled with self-absorption. And that's, to me, the essence of being charitable and just is not to be thinking so much of yourself, willing to give away things instead of hoarding them. So I really thought that when I read that book that actually what Jonathan Edwards' version of that is right. The beauty of God makes you just. I don't think she's right that just beauty makes you just.
Sure.
Because too many people love beauty and then they, you know, they're mafioso and they kill people and then they listen to wonderful music at night. And
Mozart. Kind of thing.
Yeah. So that's the part of the book you were thinking about, right?
Yes, yeah, very much so. You use this, I can't remember if you coined it or if you cite someone else, but the idea of being middle class in spirit. So as we struggle with being turned in on ourselves and needing the gospel, needing to transform us, to have this outwardness, this outward-facedness, you talk about the difference between being middle class in spirit and being poor in spirit. Talk a little bit about what you mean by middle class in spirit and how that affects one's view of those who are materially poor around them. If you're middle class in spirit, you're going to have a certain view of those materially poor around you.
Yeah, I just meant most middle class people, rightly so, work hard for what they get. Very often poor people aren't even, listen, I think at one end of the spectrum, very often poor people give up. I mean, they know if they work, they're going to get minimum wage, and they can't even pay their rent, and they just give up. They don't have the skills. They give up. And there are, obviously, it's possible to be wealthy and not work because you have the money. That's not usually true of first generation wealth, but second and third generation wealth. You know, you give kids too much money, and then they don't know what they want to do. And middle class people are the hard workers, and they've earned what they get. And I'm afraid middle class and spirit are basically legalists. Spiritually speaking, these are people who say, yes, God loves me, and I deserve it because I've worked very hard. I read the Bible, and I pray, and I'm keeping the Ten Commandments, and I'm trying my best, and he owes me a good life. That's middle class and spirit. And that's in the book. That's my idea. And what that means then, of course, is you look at poor people, and you tend to say, if you're spiritually middle class, you have a tendency to look down on poor people and say, why, what's their problem? Look at me. To be poor in spirit means I know I'm saved by grace, and I've only been saved by an act of God's intervention, and I actually am bankrupt spiritually. And by his sheer mercy and grace, he's come down and saved me. And he spent himself, you know, he emptied himself in order to save me. That's got to affect the way in which you look at the poor. It just has to. You look at a poor person and you say, excuse me, you look at a poor person and you say, why didn't you pull yourself up by your bootstraps? And of course, if God said that to you, you'd be dead spiritually. And you say, well, if I do give the person my charity and grace, then what if they abuse it? But of course, that's happened to you. God's given you grace and charity, and you've trampled on it because you haven't lived the life you should live. Mm-hmm. See, the more you see yourself as spiritually poor and the recipient of God's wonderful grace, the more you're going to be, your heart's going to go out to the poor. And you're going to, when you look at the materially poor, you know, in a sense, you're looking in a mirror. And that's my whole point, is that just generally speaking, you see in the Bible that if you're poor in spirit, you care about the poor in materially poor. And if you're middle class in spirit, you don't care about the materially poor.
Well, let me read back to you then some of your own quotes here, and this will be our last question in this section here, because I want you to address a certain type of person who's going to read these quotes, and they're going to be undone by them. For example, you have some powerful, what I would say are some statements that indict us all and our lack of heart to the poor. Page 48, you say this, you've just talked about Luke 14, Jesus describing who you should invite to a feast, and you say, quote, to put this in a more modern context, he is saying that we should spend far more money, far more of our own money and wealth on the poor than we do on our own entertainment or on vacations or on eating out and socializing with important peers. And later you note that Jesus is at least calling us to this, to not view our money as our own, and that we should be profoundly involved with and generous to the poor. Later on in the book, page 94, you note, if one doesn't care about the poor, it reveals that at best he doesn't understand the grace he has experienced, and at the worst he has not really encountered the saving mercy of God. And again, quote, if you look down at the poor and stay aloof from their suffering, you have not really understood or experienced God's grace. And of course, in excerpting quotes from the book like that, I don't mean for it to sound more heavy-handed. This was very pastoral and remarkably helpful. But we're going to read through this, and there's going to be a person who reads this and finds their heart filleted wide open by that. And they are deeply convicted, and they really want to change. So to that person who is experiencing, maybe from reading this, a deep conviction of their hard-heartedness or their lack of concern, their lack of appropriating God's grace, what do you say to that person? What are some, so they're at that point, what are some next steps for them? Where do they go with that next?
Oh, well, they're forgiven. It's the first thing. You probably will only be convicted if you really say, oh, I do know that I'm a sinner saved by grace, and I'm being hard-hearted. You'd only be convicted if you believed you're a sinner saved by grace. So the first thing you do when you find yourself being filleted, to use your cute little term, is you do have to say, Lord, please forgive me. You need to ask for forgiveness so that you're not responding out of a kind of an open wound. In other words, not responding strictly out of guilt. You want to be convicted by this, but you also don't. I don't want people to be, just bleeding, bleeding all over the page. They need to say, "Lord, forgive me." I think the second thing to do would be not to rush. I don't say too much about this, but I guess I don't say it at all in there. You know, one of the reasons why the poor are often not helped is because of simplistic understandings of how poverty comes. I do say something about this. Mm-hmm. In the book, I'd say the liberal approach to poverty is it's all systemic injustice. It's just rich people holding on to their money. White people holding on to their money and oppressing non-white people, or it's rich. So it's all a matter of systemic racism, period. And in that idea, all you have to do is just basically give the poor rights and money and everything will be fine. And the conservative view, it's all about moral failure and family failure. And I found that if you actually go into real work with poor people, with either of those reductionistic approaches, you're gonna hurt those people. You're gonna hurt them. Because the realities are very complicated. I try to say in there that there's many aspects. And I just feel like people are just too quick when they start to feel guilty to run off. They're almost afraid, like, if I need to do something quick before I lose this, before my conscience hardens again. I feel like they honestly need to take their time to find outlets that really are helping people. Outlets that they can either give money to and a little bit of involvement, or give a lot of involvement to and a little bit of money. See, some people have more time than money. And other people have more money than time. And so you have to find the place to give either your time or your money, or you know, a certain percentage of both that fit you. And I don't think it's that easy to do. I mean, even here in New York, I've got several great places to go, but I mean, not every place. It's not good enough just to send your money off to some big relief organization, though they many times some of those big relief organizations do good work. Be better for you and your family to get a little bit more involved in something that was more personal. So just don't be so quick.
We hope you've been encouraged by the broadcast tonight. If you'd like to learn more about the things that we've been discussing, especially this aspect of how the gospel of the grace of God can change our hearts and cause us to be generous in our justice, I encourage you to pick up a copy of Tim Keller's Generous Justice, How the Grace of God Makes Us Just. And you can purchase copies of that right here on the Desiring God website, desiringgod.org. If you'd like to learn more about Tim Keller or about the ministry of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City, I encourage you to go to their website, redeemer.com. That's www.redeemer.com. I'm Scott Anderson, and on behalf of the staff and the crew here, we thank you for watching this edition of Desiring God Live, and we hope that you will join us again. Until that time, may Christ remain your treasure and your joy.